Good evening, everybody. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, John.
And by the grace of God, this fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, the help of a lot of sponsors over the years, and the help of a lot of good people like you, I've been sober since September 7th, 1976, and I'm very grateful for that. Sometimes dry as a fire hazard, as they say. When Tom asked me to speak, I thought to myself, I'm glad it isn't the night of a football game. Because one time not too long ago, a couple of years ago at Alpharetta, I spoke and hardly anyone showed up because it was the night of a playoff game of some sort. And I said, well, I'm going to speak anyway. And I think there were about 10 people there. And it gave me a chance to tell them about how I feel about football. Because I love football. I used to play the game. And I used to watch it on TV all day Saturday. And then I'd watch it Sunday, and I'd get the pro plan so I could watch more than just two games on Sunday, things like this. And of course, Monday night football. And my wife, bless her heart, at the time she knew enough to just leave me alone during football season. And so that's when she used to usually go to meetings. But I noticed one day we were sitting there watching the Super Bowl, and she got the idea, and quite properly so, that football season was just about over. So at the end of the third quarter, she got up and left the room, and I was wondering what happened to her and all that. She's going to miss the fourth quarter and so forth. And when the final gun went off, I looked up, and there she was standing there by my chair, in this pretty gray negligee, and she looked really nice. She did herself up really well. And I said, well, honey, I don't believe I've ever seen that gray negligee before. And she says, this isn't gray, it's dust. So there are times where football can hurt your sobriety, and there are times when it can hurt a marriage too. So probably has done so. But I'm so happy particularly to be able to speak tonight at an anniversary, because the 33rd anniversary of Sober at Six, 33 years is 33 years of a lot of generations of AA. AA generations aren't like human generations. They're a couple years, depending on how long it takes people to sponsor other people and so forth. And so the longer something exists, like 33 years, think of all the people who have gotten sober and stayed sober because of the Sober at Six group, notwithstanding the way it got started and all that. But I appreciate the chance to speak to you tonight. And to begin with, when I first came in to AA and had to admit, had to surrender, had to say that I'm powerless over alcohol, my life had become unmanageable, I did that all right, and I believed it. But I also was kind of angry. I said to God, I says, why me, Lord? Why me? I used to say that all the time to him. He and I used to talk, but I did all the talking in those days. And why have you made me an alcoholic? And most people aren't. Why me? And after I had been sober for a while, didn't even take too long, 5 or 6 months or something like that, going to a lot of meetings, getting to know a lot of people in AA, and finding out just how wonderful this program was and so forth, I started to say, why not me? why not me? I'm very fortunate to have even found this group. Most alcoholics never find AA, and therefore most alcoholics die drunk, die younger than they should have anyway. And so we are all very fortunate to be here, no matter how long we've been here. If we're here tonight, if we're sober, we're richly blessed. I was born in El Paso, Texas in 1942. And I can even remember the end of World War II because they were all celebrating. That was a military town. My father explained to me why they were celebrating on VJ Day. But the war was over. And it was a great time to grow up. And I had wonderful parents. I can't blame anything about my drinking or anything else I've done on my parents or my siblings, because I had a wonderful family. My father was the greatest man I've ever known, and that's how I see my father. He died young because he was a disabled veteran, and he wasn't going to live to be very old anyway. But he had wisdom like I've never seen. He was also someone who never took a hand to me. I've never heard him raise his voice. I've never seen him angry. And that's very unusual for the oldest son in the family to say. Especially in those days, they were a lot stricter back then. And I felt very fortunate to have the father I did. Because all he had to do if he was disappointed in me was to just look disappointed. And that would tear me up. That was the worst punishment I could have. In fact, I'd go to him as soon as I can and straighten it out. And then he'd talk to me. But he'd always talk to me. He never yelled at me or anything else. My mother was a great mother. I mean, we had the best cook in the world, everything else. And plus, she was an organizer. She always ran the PTA, which means I couldn't get away with anything. She even ran my high school PTA. And you get mothers saying to their sons, why can't you be like John here? You know, and all that. And I'd be just like them if I weren't being watched all the time. But she was a wonderful mother. Great sister, great brother. Both of them highly successful in life. We were all successful because of what our parents passed on to us. I grew up in the church. I'm very well churched. And I consider that an advantage. You know, when people come into Alcoholics Anonymous, so many people say, if I ever hear that God thing, I'm heading right out the door. And some of them do and some of them don't. But I was fortunate to have a pretty good contact with God, even though I used to argue with him all the time. And that gave me a good start in AA when I finally did come into it when I was 34. But I grew up in the church. I lived right next near the cathedral in El Paso, Texas, the Catholic cathedral there. And from the time I was 6 years old, I was in that church because I was always a singer, and I was in the cathedral boys choir from the time I was 6 years old. I was an altar boy when I was 8 years old. I was never going to be anything but a Catholic priest. And that's what I was being raised to become. Except during my growing up, I always felt conflicted. And I felt conflicted because of conflicting signals you get from different people in the church and so forth. Like I had the nuns in grade school. And I think about, and most of them were pretty good. A couple of them I was afraid of. And I think of an old friend named Sandy Beach who died in 2014, but he spoke for years in AA all over the place, and just probably one of the best, if not close to the best around. And I heard him first when I was only about a year and a half sober, and he was young. He was young then, and he always talked about his Catholic schooling with the nuns, and he'd say, "You know, I was a real well-adjusted kid and all that, a real happy-go-lucky kid, until the nuns told me about purgatory. And then I was screwed up for the rest of my childhood and all that." Gave him a complex. Well, in a way, it did that to me, because especially when we were adolescents and so forth, coming up in the seventh and eighth grades and all that, the way you were taught by the nuns, you couldn't even look at a girl without committing a serious sin. And then they'd blame the girl for looking attractive. And this is a fact back then. It's not. And so I was always running to confession. But I was starting to think, you know, I'm not good enough to be a priest. You know, I'm just not going to make it. I just don't have the moral character to be. And then I was also, I was the bishop's altar boy when he said masses at 6 a.m. every morning during the week. And I was his altar boy, and he'd say it off a private chapel off the cathedral. And then I'd have breakfast with him and then walk up to my high school, which was only two blocks away, which was Cathedral High School, the Christian Brothers. And I was his vocation. He was going to get me into the priesthood, and he was all set to send me to North American College in Rome, which is a seminary, and he had one slot a year he could send somebody to. And that was kind of an honorable thing to get. At the last minute, you know, I just said, you know, I don't think I can give up girls, give up women, you know, and I was serious. Who says I have to go right now? I talked to my father about it, and that's what he said. He says, "Well, you don't have to go right now. You can, if you change your mind, you can go next year or something like that." But the bishop never spoke to me after that, after I went and told him. The guy who took my place at the seminary became a bishop, and he's a friend of mine today, and I visit him whenever I get through. He lives in Las Cruces, New Mexico, and he's retired. But when he introduces me, he says, "This guy's the reason I became a bishop, because I got I got to go to the seminary in Rome." It was too late to apply for any colleges. I was about to graduate from high school, and so I decided, even though I was at the top of my high school class, I'll just go into the Air Force, and I went to the recruiting office and went into the Air Force, just get the GI Bill and then go to any college I want, because I scored very high on the college board exams. And it was a good plan. Good plan around that time. This was 1960. So I went to enlist in the Air Force, and then some officer came out, a captain who was at the recruiting station. He says, "You know, you scored the maximum score on all the exams, the electrical, the mechanical, the administrative, and the general." And he says, "Have you ever heard of the Air Force Academy Prep School?" And I says, "No, I haven't." And he says, "Well, they have one now. They're sending half of them to the Naval Academy Prep School and half of them to the West Point Prep School until they get it built at the Air Force Academy." And so they sent 50 to one and 50 to the other. And I says, "Well, might as well." Didn't know what I wanted to do in the Air Force at that age. And So I ended up at the prep school, and I ended up getting an appointment. I went to the Naval Academy prep school, got appointments to both academies, and took the Air Force Academy. And 4 years later, came out as a second lieutenant. Got married. I met my wife at the time. I met her while I was a cadet at the Air Force Academy. I was singing for the Air Force Academy Cadet Chorale. We went to sing on the Ed Sullivan Show in New York. And she was singing with Mary Martin in The Sound of Music. And so I met her, and we were duly impressed, and we got married after I graduated. And it was the worst marriage you could imagine. Actually, not really. We looked good, you know. People would invite us over. The senior officers would invite us over because they said, what a beautiful couple, you know, and all that. We got married at St. Patrick's Cathedral in New York. And we had three lovely daughters. And that's the good thing about the marriage. Whatever marriage goes foul and all that, remember the good parts about it, which are your children. And so I started drinking pretty hard when I was 16. And I didn't drink every day and all that. But I found something out when I drank, that it had very little effect on me. I used to drink, well, we'd go over to Juarez, Mexico, which was right across the border, and it cost a dime for a shot of tequila over there at the bar. You'd line up these shot glasses, so the group of us would go over and start drinking down tequila. Or I like drinking whiskey or gin, vodka if it had Kahlua with it. But it never had much of an effect on me. And people would say, you know, the other people would get obviously drunk, and I'd never seem to. And when I went to the Air Force Academy, we couldn't drink while we were there. But any time I got away from the place, it was only by the grace of God that I got back on time from privileges, going out on the town and things like that. Somebody always make sure I got back. And so I managed to make it through my 4 years there. But I always drank a lot when I drank. And I liked it. I liked the taste of it. I liked the warm feeling you got and all that. But I wouldn't get dizzy. I didn't pass out. I just keep drinking, and seemed to have a great capacity. And at that time, I was proud of it, because even when I quit, when I was 34 years old, my boss said, I don't know why you quit drinking. He says, you could hold it better than any of us. And it's true. I was the one that would drive people home, because they were wiped out, and I had sometimes three and four times as much as they had to drink. And it just, you know, alcohol was just a part of my life. I was a highly successful officer in the military. I was winning a lot of decorations and awards and for things I'd done and everything else and accomplishments. And actually got promoted to major early, ahead of my peers, which is in the top 5%. And that's when I was thinking of getting out of the Air Force. I had no intention of ever making it my career. And I was at the 9-year point then, and I says, then I got promoted early, and I says, well, I better think about this and stay in. And so that was the time that I had reached the low point in my alcoholism. Up to then, I didn't have a low point. I'd go travel a lot in the Air Force. I was the staff negotiator for Strategic Air Command. I used to go out and settle contract disputes and claims and things like that. And so I'd go out and negotiate, and I always had a backlog of work out in the field. And my wife was nagging me constantly about my drinking. Because what did I do most of my... Whenever I was home, I did it at home. And I used to buy liquor by the case. And then I would... And it would be about a bottle a night. And sometimes more if people came over. Then I go to work the next morning. And if she got on my nerves too much or nagged me too much, I'd call the boss and say, I'm going on a trip tomorrow to Minot Air Force Base. And I had blanket orders, and so I could travel anywhere at the command at will. And so I just leave town and on a business trip. And then I come back. And this went on for a few years. And all of a sudden, I come back from Ellsworth Air Force Base in South Dakota. I remember the base and everything, because the cab left me off it from brought me from the airport to my house, and I had somebody from the sheriff's office waiting for me right there, and presented me with divorce papers. And it seems my wife left a note inside. She had taken the children and gone back to New York. It was the summertime of 1976. Took the children and went to New York. And so I was there alone. And over the course of the divorce proceedings and all that, they told us to... go see this certain marriage counselor that the court appointed, or she had a counselor and I had a different one. But the counselor that I had, you know, it's almost like I'm telling you that God was leading me this way, because the counselor that I had suggested to me that, she says, do you think you might have a problem with alcohol and all that? And I says, no, I really don't. You know, I go to work every day. Geez, I'm doing great guns. You know, I've just been highly successful. But at home, I was feeling miserable as heck, to the point where I was traveling more frequently, getting out. So she said, well, you know, your wife divorced you, and the reason given was your alcoholism. So I said, you know, first of all, I didn't want to get divorced. I was not interested in my marriage wrecking. If I could put it back together, I would. And I said, if this caused my marriage to dissolve, then I'm going to try and quit drinking. So, and she said, well, if you're going to try and quit drinking, I want you to read this book. And she gave me the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was, she says, this is my private copy, and so I need it back. But if you go ahead and read this, you may have a lot of time on your hands if you are trying to stop drinking. And so that night, it was a Tuesday night. That was the first night in many years that I didn't drink anything. And I also didn't sleep all night. I was happy to watch television, but television back in 1976 ended at midnight. No cable or anything like that. So what am I going to do after midnight? I'm up all night. I read the book. I just about read it through, all through the stories and everything else, before dawn. And I called my boss the next morning and I said, you know, I need some personal time. You know, I just got filed on for divorce and all that. He says, sure, take all the time you need. So I said, I'll be gone the rest of the week. So Wednesday, same thing happens. Wednesday night, I'm watching TV. TV goes off at midnight. I try to go to sleep. I can't go to sleep. Thursday, same process starts over again. I haven't slept now in 3 days. And so I was about to not sleep for 3 days, because Thursday night comes along. And then sometime early in the evening, actually not too late, it was before midnight, because the TV was still on the next day when I first noticed it, I started hallucinating like crazy. It was the worst experience I ever had in my life. I thought I died and went to hell. And I had never thought about DTs. Some people don't get them, or have to drink a lot more than I did to get them and all that. But I woke up on Friday at noon, and on a soaking floor. It was soaking wet from sweat. And the phone was ringing above me on the counter. And so I picked up the phone. I finally got up, picked up the phone, and it was this counselor. She says, "I'm just calling to see if you had any luck quitting drinking." And I said, "Well, let me tell you what happened." And she says, "Oh my gosh, I had no idea you drank that much." And I said, "Probably because I didn't tell you." And she says, "Well, how do you feel now?" And I says, "If this is the way you feel not drinking, I feel like I'm better off drinking." And she says, "Oh no, don't do that." She says, "Whatever you do, don't do that." She says, "Can you meet me?" And she introduced me to my first AA meeting that night. It happened to be right next to the Air Force base that I go to, and I knew a lot of people in that meeting. It was a large group like this, and then they'd break it down into smaller groups for discussion. And one was the beginner's meeting. And I was the only beginner, brand new one. They had some with a couple of months, and then they had a gal named Peggy Martin who was the chair of the meeting. And Peggy was responsible. Many of you have been around, know her, because she's spoken at many AA functions around the country. But she's also got over 55 years sobriety right now. But she's responsible for my catching on and staying in AA. She had that meeting just steered to me, if there ever was. And collectively, the people in that room told my story. I could relate just a little to some, a lot to others. But collectively, they told my story, where I really didn't have any alternative but to say that I'm John and I'm an alcoholic. And they got me back to a meeting the following night and the following day. And then, you know, I started out going to 8 meetings a week, and I did for months. I went to 2 on Fridays, and I continued to go to work. And even when I traveled, because I still had to travel, we used to have like a phone directory in AA before the internet came out. And that's it, when and where. That's all the meetings in the country and worldwide, actually. And so I'd plan my meetings before I went on a trip and make sure somebody got me to them and so forth, and because it was that important. I grew to love AA very fast. I stayed with it, and the times I got away for any length of time, like when I moved or when I had too many conflicting things and couldn't go to all the meetings I wanted to go to, I really felt it, you know, because I usually couldn't wait to get to my meetings. That's the way I am today. I have certain meetings I go to, and I can't wait to get to them. But anyway, the divorce went through, and wisely they told me, don't get sober for her, get sober for yourself, and that I did. And along comes somebody I met, and we became fast friends, and I met her in the program at her very first meeting. She happened to sit down next to me. It was her very first meeting, and she was the type that walked in the room and all heads turned. She was extremely attractive. a gal, and and when she passed away at her funeral in 2015, Peggy Martin was there, and she says, "I was there when John and Maria met," and this was 38 years later, and when they met, she walked in the room, all heads turned, and John was smitten, and people got a good laugh out of that after a funeral, and so we're, but anyway, we had a great life together, and she did go back out drinking for about a 6-year period, and that was a period that I was in Al-Anon as well as AA. And I'll never make Al-Anon jokes. I got a lot out of Al-Anon. If I hadn't learned what I learned in Al-Anon, I'd have been miserable. I just wouldn't have been able, even if I was going to AA meetings all the time. But so the whole program, AA, Al-Anon, everything is really a wonderful thing. And it's a wonderful thing in my life. Now, I tend to skip around quite a bit because I could easily talk for about 2 hours if I just go through the drunkalogue and go through getting sober and so forth. So I'll talk about a few things that were important to me in my life. First of all, my turning it over to the care of God as I understood Him. AA didn't cancel out my religion. It made it better. I could see God from a different standpoint than the ones the nuns taught me, that I was that I had one foot in hell, or at least I thought I did, and that maybe there was some hope for me. And you taught me that, not the church or anything else. But when I looked at God that way, it made me appreciate my own faith more. The good thing about my life is I never left that faith. I would always go to church on Sunday. The whole time I was drinking, everything else, I'd get up if I was hungover or whatever and go to church. But that's probably because I always sang in a choir. And if I didn't sing in the choir, chances are I'd have left the church a long time ago. But I was like somebody standing on the sidelines waiting to get into the football game, wanting to play but couldn't play because I'd wrecked my life so much. And I'd wrecked my life with those character defects that we came out of. Now in the church they'll call those sins. but that I can't, that I made a list of, and we went through the fourth and fifth steps, and the sixth and seventh was so important. I think to show how important it is, how important God has been in my life and guiding my life, I like to recite a short poem or missive that is actually written by Anonymous back in the Civil War time frame, by a soldier. And it goes like this: I asked God for strength that I might achieve. I was made weak that I might learn humbly to obey. I asked for health that I might do greater things. I was given infirmities that I might do better things. I asked for riches that I might be happy. I was given poverty that I might be wise. I asked for power that I might be great in the eyes of men. I was given weakness that I might feel the need of God. I asked for all things that I might enjoy life. I was given life that I might enjoy all things. I got nothing that I asked for, but everything that I had hoped for. Almost despite myself, my unspoken prayers were answered. I am among all men most richly blessed. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I have been very richly blessed in just that way. And I've been richly blessed because I didn't get what I prayed for. God rarely gave me what I prayed for. I prayed for a military assignment, and he gave me one that I specifically didn't want. You know, and in all cases, they all turned out better than they would have otherwise. In fact, some cases it would have been a disaster if I'd gotten what I asked for. And so I learned very early in my first year of sobriety, I learned this. Here I was, when I got promoted to major in the Air Force, first thing I did, and this was when I was very new in the program, first thing I did is, now I got to see how to get promoted to lieutenant colonel. And so, because I was an ambitious young officer. And so what I did is looked around for the next assignment, and I found one to negotiating with the Shah of Iran, doing business over there, out of the embassy for military hardware and things like that. And it was, I had to go to Washington to interview for this job in the Secretary of the Air Force's office, because it was called the Secretary of the Air Force Special Projects Office. And everything was highly classified and so forth. And so I actually get the assignment. I got a call one morning when I walked in, and the military personnel says, "You got the assignment." And it was a lieutenant colonel slot that I was going to, and everything else. So I was just as happy as can be. And then my boss comes to me and he says, "The general wants to see you and me." And so we went to his office. I says, "I can't think of anything going on. Do you, could you?" And he says, "No, not really." And says, "But the general wants to see us." And we had this major general who was my boss's boss. And he says, "We don't want you to go to Iran." He says, "We need you here in SAC. We don't want you to leave SAC." And I wasn't very happy. I says, "You know, I got this highly selective job, and I just got notified about it." He says, "We knew that." And he says, "We got notified about it too." And he says, "But we want you to go down to Carswell Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas." I didn't mind going to Fort Worth, Texas. I'm a Texan and I love Fort Worth. But I says, "Carswell," I says, "do you realize they've had 4 base contracting officers down there in the last 5 years?" And I mean, it was a mess, that office, and it 8 careers. And he says, "That's why we're sending you there." And I felt like saying, "Don't do me any favors," but you can't tell a general that. But I was unhappy. I was very unhappy. And I kind of asked God, I says, "You know, I hope you have something in mind from this, because Carswell was specifically the base I did not want to go to, and if I had to go somewhere else." So I went down there, and the guy that took my place in Iran, that they assigned there, was a prisoner of the Ayatollah for a year and a half. You know, they were captured. Some of the older people know the history behind that, but and he was never the same. He was medically retired from the Air Force when he got out. And I'm saying, you know, God might be looking out for me. And I just couldn't believe it. I was in awe when this happened. And especially since I got promoted to lieutenant colonel at the end of the assignment down there, and I cleaned that office up real good. And moved on and to several other assignments. And eventually, I wound up at the Pentagon, where I was deputy director of contracting for the Air Force. And so I was in one of these jobs where it was a nerve center. Every bad procurement that goes on, or every complaint from some major contractor, I had to settle it, and you know, or figure out some way to settle it or get somebody to. And my fellow colonels came around, and they said, don't you just hate it here, John? How can you stand it? They hated going to the Pentagon. I didn't want to go to the Pentagon either, but I wound up there. Just prior to that, I had gotten the director's job that I had in SAC in Omaha, and I loved that job. But I says, well, I just kind of take things one day at a time, and I had a sense of humor, and I think things that, and I found out something about Alcoholics Anonymous. If you haven't figured out, the people who've lived these principles, if you live these principles, you have an edge on other people. You actually do. It gives you strength to carry on in things that would otherwise be a pain in the neck. And I just, one day at a time, I would go. I didn't worry. Often I would, my boss would come in. I worked for a two-star general there. I was his deputy. And he said, listen, the Secretary of the Air Force needs a quick briefing on this particular subject. I says, when does he want it? And he says, Wednesday morning. Well, this might be Monday morning. So I call his office and get on his calendar. And I write a few things down, and I make a slide or have somebody make it for me. Then I just put it in my drawer, and I never picked it up again until 15 minutes before I had to brief him and walked in. There was a time I used to worry all night long, never get any sleep before a briefing like that. And he was happy. He says, thanks, John. That's exactly what I needed to know. But I could take care of life so easily at work or anything else. It just teaches you how to live. If you can live by this program. So people who are thinking about how that could ever happen to me, it sure can. You just got to be patient. You got to just practice it every day. Some of us just get old, and so we build up a lot of time in AA and things like that, but we're able to do those things. And AA makes you younger. That's another thing I like to tell people. It actually makes you younger. There's so much to do in AA that keeps us active. And so one more thing I like to mention. The psychologist will tell you that the thing that man craves more than anything else, what they want, the basic thing of man is, I want to live. Why then do we have people that take their lives? A lot of people in this program, or who've been in this program, when they leave us. Why? Because of the second want of man, which is, I want to be loved. And if you are not loved or feel that you're not loved, and let's face it, a lot of people, when they first reach this program, their families left them, their friends have left them, their boss has fired them, people shy away from them. They are not loved, and they don't feel loved. They are in a world of hurt when they come in. And the wonderful thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is there's a lot of love in this room. How do you get love back in your life? Just by letting people know that you want to get sober and you want to do whatever it takes in this program, and you'll have all the love you can stand. And so people very often get that love back here in this program, and then eventually as they their life improves and everything else, they'll gain some of the loves back they had before. Maybe their family, maybe not. Keep that in mind. Keep that in mind. There's a lot of love in these rooms. And for that reason, I say, don't leave us. If you come in here, stay. Stay. I don't care how angry you are, or somebody rubbed you the wrong way, or you don't feel you really need this program anymore. Stay. Stay no matter how lousy you feel, because otherwise that love will leave your life again and you may never get back to us. And one last thing, and I'm right on the right on the cusp. But one last thing is back to the sixth step, six and seven. Those character defects, which the church likes to call sin. The wonderful thing about this program, it got me working on my character defects with God's help, but He didn't remove all of them right away. I got a number of them removed early, almost right away, and a number of them over the years left. But the one that I most wanted to remove, something I was very ashamed of and all that, and was actually keeping me away from God, pushing me away from God, was still there. And I would pray every day. To the point where I go to church every morning. I go to church every morning to this day. I did that to help me get through my caretaking of my wife, to give me the strength, because I was her caretaker for the last 3 years of her life. And I just kept going. And it gives me a chance to pray for all the for a lot of people in AA. I have a regular list in my mind. And there are people who know that I pray for them and all that. And especially if they've left and they need to come back. But I will always do it because prayer works. And I talk to God. I meditate when I go to church. I talk to Him and He talks to me. I don't hear His voice in my ears, but I hear it in my heart. And then when I do, I'm ready to leave there, and I know what the next right thing to do that day is. It just seems to come to me. And so I was walking one night outside, and it was a nice day about a year and a half ago, and that character defect that I just couldn't get rid of, and I kept praying, God, take this away from me, and so forth, I realized, hey, I haven't done this in months. I haven't exercised that character defect in months. It's gone. It is literally gone, and yet I prayed that morning to get rid of that character defect. And at that point, and it hasn't come back, and at that point I realized that I've made my peace with God. And if you're as old as I am, you realize how important that starts to get. So I can honestly say, that I believe that the best years of my life are ahead of me, in this life and the next. And I wish you lasting sobriety. I wish your life be happy, joyous, and free. And that the best years of your life are ahead of you in this life or the next. And may God bless you always. Yeah.